Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge Muncie community. I'm Kaylin McPherson.
And I'm Marcia Lazarus. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Moses Nagel will report on the pro-Palestinian rallies happening at colleges and universities, and he speaks with Barbara Smith to give us some context. Then Elizabeth, EP Press, reports on the traffic conditions once the new Chick-fil-A goes in on Hoosick Street. Later on, Willie Terry interviews author Terry Ann Roberts about her children's book, I Deserve Better, and accompanying coloring book, Color, Repeat, Believe. After that, we will be talking with local comedian Bree Morrison. And finally, Tom Francis introduces us to a local poet, Rachel Baum, who tells us how she began writing poetry during the pandemic, collecting funeral poems, and starting an open mic. But first, here are the headlines.
A state Supreme Court justice upheld a jury verdict that awarded more than $191,000 to a wastewater treatment worker who was fired by the city of Amsterdam 4 years ago and after testing positive for cannabis that has been prescribed to him for chronic back pain.
Wayne Spence is running for an unprecedented fourth term as president of the Public Employees Federation. Spence has pushed to expand remote work flexibility and improve staffing across several government agencies. While he has challenged what he views as the toxic work environments for many employees, his challenger, Union Vice President Sharon DeSilva, has accused Spence of overseeing PEF's own toxic workplace, especially for women.
The Times Union reports that the governor has signed a series of laws to improve the safety of stretched limousines in response to the accident that killed 20 in Schoharie. The new laws, including one that mandates the stretched limos are retired from service after 10 years or 350,000 miles. We were recommended by the state's stretched limousines passenger safety task force.
And the Gazette reports that a $5.1 million renovation project at the Schenectady County Recreational Facility is underway, more than a year after officials announced plans to upgrade the facility using federal coronavirus relief dollars. The 25-year-old skating rink is home to dozens of youth and adult hockey teams.
With a state-mandated deadline to electrify its bus fleet by 2035, the Gazette reports that Shenandoah Central School District is considering constructing a substation to power the vehicles with a price tag of upwards of $30 million. The district presidency has 215 gas-powered buses.
And finally, the Record reports that Hudson Valley Community College has established three new walking trails at the north end of campus for public use, developed to improve mental health, encourage fitness and wellness, and increase time outdoors. Meanwhile, a faculty union is suing the college over its refusal to publicly release an assessment of public safety at the college. The study will be presented, however, to a college task force that includes both faculty and students. That's it for the headlines.
And for those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital region through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers, and to learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org or email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or you can call us at 518-272-2390.
Now, moving right along to our first segment, producer Moses Nagel reports on the latest rally of a series of college campuses protests at the University of Albany, a movement in solidarity with Gaza and the Palestinian movement. He speaks with longtime feminist scholar and author Barbara Smith for some historical context.
On Monday, students held a walkout and rally for Gaza on the campus of UAlbany, organized by Students for Justice for Palestine. Albany became the latest in a rapidly growing list of college campuses around the country that in the last few weeks have seen students sit in, rally, and start encampments in protest of the mass killings of Palestinians by the Israeli military. Here's an excerpt of a speech delivered on Collins Circle in the center of campus Monday. Barbara Smith is a local activist, scholar, feminist, and former member of Albany Common Council. She's a member of Albany Jewish Voice for Peace and Ukraine Solidarity Capital District. I spoke with her yesterday for some historical perspective on the explosion of student activism we have seen recently.
We are living in incredible times, both on the negative side, the tragic side, the diabolical side, but also on the side of vision, on the side of courage and inspiration, people organizing to make things different. One of the things that I have been thinking is, what's radical about wanting to stop humans from dying? What is radical about that? I don't think it's radical to try to keep people from dying. But yet, because of politics and political understandings and political differences, the students, by some, are being characterized as radical, as being stupid, as being naive about not understanding the issues, etc. I was a junior in college in the spring of 1968. although I graduated from Mount Holyoke and started at Mount Holyoke. So I basically designed a junior year abroad. And for me, abroad was New York City. I went to the New School College, which was a new program that they had started at that time. And what it actually was a program for student activists and organizers who were dissatisfied with the kind of education they were getting where they currently were. And I realized when we had our first meeting of the class, I said, my goodness, these are some of the most dissident students in the country. But when Columbia University then went out on strike in April of 1968, the New School College, which is downtown in the village, our professors canceled our classes because they just assumed that we would wish to be up at Columbia with other student organizers. So for those of us of my vintage, seeing what's happening now and having experienced what's happened then, there are a lot of echoes, there are a lot of connections. But just like when I was a student, we were trying to stop people from dying. In that context, it was a war in Vietnam. It was another group of brown people from the global south, the Vietnamese. But many echoes, many echoes.
You've been working on this exact issue and organizing locally for a number of months now. I'm curious about why now we've seen this explosion of activism at this moment, or if you have thoughts about that.
What we're seeing is a burgeoning of a movement, a global movement. And there's more attention being paid to the occupation in Palestine imposed by the Israeli government. When I refer to Israel, I'm talking about the government. I'm not talking about the Israeli population, and I'm definitely not talking about people who are Jewish, because I have opposed anti-Semitism, and in writing, anybody can look it up, because I'm a co-author of a book that's titled Yours in Struggle, Three Feminist Perspectives on Anti-Semitism and Racism. It was written by an Ashkenazi Jewish woman, by a Southern Christian-raised white woman, and by me. It was published in 1984. There are more people now who are aware of the situation in Gaza and in the West Bank and with Palestinians. But you can't predict history going forward. You just can't. You can look back on it and say, that's why that happened. We're in it right now. So anything that we say could turn out not to be, it certainly will not be the full picture. We can use our best instincts and our best guesses. But this is an outpouring, a global outpouring of outrage at what is, I think, accurately defined as a genocide in our lifetime, ethnic cleansing in our lifetime. The occupation is verifiable. That's been going on since 1948. So we don't have to even argue about did that happen or did it not happen. One of the things that has inspired me the most, one of the things that we did was to pass the first ceasefire resolution in New York State, the very first one that was passed on January the 4th by the Albany Common Council. And one of the most important, significant aspects of doing that work and that organizing is that we got to work with people in the Muslim, Arab American, and Palestinian community here in the capital region. Links have been made and connections have been made that did not exist beforehand. So we're doing the best we can.
That was quite an accomplishment. I think in some ways, those things laid the groundwork of what we're seeing now. Let's just go back for a moment to what you were talking about in 1968, the protests in Columbia and the Democratic Convention that year. And a lot of that was driven by people willing to make personal sacrifices, right? To stand
right,
up
indeed.
For these things. And maybe that's something that we're finally seeing now. I mean, these students being threatened with being suspended or expelled from their universities. Do you feel like you won those struggles back then against the Vietnam War?
We definitely stopped the war in Vietnam. We absolutely stopped that war. If not for the people's movement on the ground protesting the war in Vietnam, it never would have happened. I think there's a thing about being on the right side of history, or what I would call the ethical side of history. When people are being abused, annihilated, when they don't have full human rights, particularly when compared to other people nearby who control them, that's the time to speak up and to speak out. So that's what we're trying to do.
Barbara Smith has recently re-released a 25th anniversary edition of The Truth That Never Hurts, Writings on Race, Gender, and Freedom, and the 40th anniversary edition of Homegirls, a Black feminist anthology. Reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, this is Moses Nagel.
And you can learn more about the life and work of Albany's very own Barbara Smith at barbarasmithaintgonna.com. BarbaraSmithaintGonna.com.
And Chick-fil-A is planning to build nearly 3,500 square feet store on Hoosick Street in Brunswick. Residents are very concerned about the impact on the already high trafficked corridor. HMM correspondent Elizabeth E.P. Press speaks to organizers of the grassroots organizing effort to demonstrate the impact.
Okay, so Angela, we're in the car on Hoosick Street traffic. It's 4:29 on Friday.
Right there. Can you just talk to her?
We're approaching the intersection of North and South Lake.
On Friday evening, my family and I hopped into the car and joined the grassroots organized effort to emulate the traffic study that was conducted to show the impact of traffic that a proposed Chick-fil-A may have on Hoosick Road. Chick-fil-A plans to open a store in Brunswick, and the added traffic is a concern for many.
Why is there a flag sitting out a window?
We've been backed up now.
Look at this.
For
approximately
10 minutes trying to get down this way. Bumper to bumper, I guess. Nope, just missed the light again. That car made it right in the middle of the intersection.
When we finally got to the Walmart parking lot in Brunswick, organizers were directing traffic to line up into three rows.
Hi, you can go to the stop sign to a hairpin turn. This is grassroots at its finest.
It is. It's really awesome.
Thank you for coming out. Yeah. Oh, hey, you. If you want to just follow that car, we're going to wait till every lineup pull out.
My name's Leland. Last name's Armsby. Been up and down this corridor for almost 60 years, and I remember when all this was beautiful farmland way back when, but, you know, you can't turn that time back, unfortunately. It's just we have enough retail space. We don't need any more.
Yeah.
So, we did a simulation to see. We have a traffic report with some retail space that's supposed to come in to the Hoosick Street corridor again, and it is just so congested as it is now. They're saying it's going to add 100-plus cars to the traffic flow. I just turned off of 15th Street for this simulation, and it took me 28 minutes to get up Hoosick Street to Walmart. It's a little bit just overbuilt at this point, and people are just overflowing into the side streets and communities through the park, beautiful Freer Park, you know? So I think not only is it a situation that could become dangerous, it's just way overdone, you know? Even the GPS... If you're trying to map something, it pushes you off the corridor of Hoosick Street because they know it's going to add 30 minutes to your trip. It's got to stop. I mean, there's enough commercial space here to offset our taxes in the town of Brunswick. That's just my opinion.
Yeah. So you have an orange flag. What does it represent?
Well, we've got all of our flags here. It's just to show what kind of congestion we're going to see. This isn't even at peak hours is what they're saying. So we just figured we would kind of identify ourselves with the rest of the traffic. So as people are coming through, you know, we had a few heads turned. They probably thought I had something on the car here I shouldn't have, but yeah. But
wow, this is more cars than I expected.
I think you too. Can I come out of the car and talk to you for a minute?
So I got out of the car and interviewed Jennifer Mann. She was helping direct traffic and was seeing many familiar faces.
We are here to try to get some attention on the fact that a Chick-fil-A is just not the right thing for our town at this time with the current traffic problems we already have.
Describe what you see in front of your eyes with the sea of cars that have gathered here as a grassroots effort to simulate what?
We foiled Chick-fil-A's traffic study that they did to show their projections of how many cars would be on the road if they built their new store on Hoosick Road. And we tried to simulate that as best we can, with people going in both directions, to be as, you know, as faithful to their numbers as we could. So we have approximately 90 cars that are here going either up or down Hoosick Street and then convened here in the Walmart parking lot to show just the volume of cars that are, this is new trips that will be generated by a Chick-fil-A. This is not just the traffic that's going to be stopping incidentally on the side to grab dinner. These are new trips. 96 new cars are expected to be on the road during the evening commute because of that Chick-fil-A.
And is the Chick-fil-A a done deal?
It is not yet. It's going through the planning board and the zoning board. It is not officially okayed yet, and we're trying to do this hopefully in time before it would be, and we're hoping to make a difference.
And what are you finding? I know today was like seemingly a little bit lighter for people, but I talked to a few people that said it took them over 30 minutes from 15th Street to this Walmart parking lot. What are people reporting from their personal stories as you greet them here today?
So I am pretty sure this is still going to be a traffic nightmare.
So now there's three lanes of cars waiting to go. They're starting to move. What do people do now after they've gathered here?
We're just having them go home at this point. They're dispersing. We just wanted to get them all together, have them go up and down the road to show this is what 96 additional cars looks like. And now they're just going to head home.
Great. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you want to say?
One thing that I think is really important to note is that Chick-fil-A is building a 5,300 square foot store on Central Ave, and that is the same size they are building here on Hoosick Road. We are not Central Ave. We are a much smaller area, and that is just not an appropriate size store for this area, and that's just going to generate an insane amount of traffic, and it's just not the right thing for us.
Could you tell me about where they're going to install and build their store and what they're going to do to build it?
Yes, they are going where McChesney Avenue comes in between Walmart and Price Chopper Plazas. Across the street, Chick-fil-A has purchased three or four homes. They're going to tear them down and build a nearly 5,300 square foot Chick-fil-A, about 2,500 square foot Chipotle, and a retail space that is supposed to be a mattress store, and I'm not sure how big that's going to be.
And if someone hears this radio piece, is there a way that they could tap into the grassroots effort of organizing, or are there next steps that to know about?
I would say just to come to the Brunswick Town Council meetings. They are the second Thursday of every month at 7 p.m. at the Brunswick Town Office. And even if you're not a resident, you can come and voice your concern, because this is going to impact residents of Troy, Pittstown, towns all around us. And so you should have a say as well. Yeah, pack it in. Okay. Pack it in. Okay, so maybe we do need to make another lane, but I don't know how we're going to do that.
All right, so everybody in
Walgreens?
I think so, yeah. Everybody in this line is going to go, and then this line will start. And we're just asking people to go down to like North Lake, and then you can go home. You're free.
Thank you.
Thank you.
After waiting in line with the rest of the cars lined up, we finally left, driving back down Hoosick Road in Friday night rush hour traffic toward Troy.
Thank you.
That was so long.
Was it? Did it feel long? Wait till you get the trip
thank
home.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
It took us about 30 minutes to get home. There are already Chick-fil-A restaurants operating in Clifton Park, North Greenbush, and at the Albany International Airport. Chick-fil-A restaurants are also proposed for Central Ave in Albany and in Latham. For the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, this is EP, or Elizabeth Press, with Angela and Sylvan and Amber.
And if you would like to express your concerns and support this organizing effort, come to a Brunswick Town Council's meeting held on the second Thursday of every month at 7 p.m. at the Brunswick Town Office.
And for those just tuning in, I'm Kalen McPherson.
And I'm Marcia Lazarus, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOG LP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
And if you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content on your favorite platform. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
So next, Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry interviewed author Terry Ann Roberts about her children's book, I Deserve Better, and accompanying coloring book, Color, Repeat, Believe. Roberts cares very much about sharing this book with children in schools and libraries and participated recently in the Albany Public Library's Community Wellness Fair.
Hello, this is Willie Terry, your roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm here today on the phone with Terrion Robinson, who is an author of a book called I Deserve Better. And how you doing,
Terry? I'm doing just fine.
So, Terrion, before we get started, why don't you like just tell our audience a little bit about you?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I'm a wife, mother of three. I have three boys. The oldest is Jaden. He's actually a freshman up that way, closer to you, at Marist College, where he plays basketball and is a sports communication major. And I also have boys who are 11, Ace and Ross, and I share them, you know, with my husband, Keith. We are all, you know, we're from New Jersey, born and raised. I met you up in Albany at an event at an elementary school, and I was there promoting my book, I Deserve Better, as well as my coloring book, Color, Repeat, Believe. And I'm doing as much as I can to get in more places and spaces to try to promote my book, but also to, because of the message of my book, really try to get in with kids as much as possible, have the discussions, do readings and all that good stuff.
So, now, you know, I was reading the flyer that they had put out about your event at the library. And it said that your book was earned the number one spot on the Amazon new release list.
It did, yeah.
And what was that like?
That was, you know, that was a shock for me. And the funny thing is, someone actually had to tell me that that happened because I didn't know. You know, the book sales are great, comes with the territory. But, you know, to be honest, that is not what drives me. That's not, you know, it's necessary. That's not, you know, what I do it for. Like, I literally love to be in the classroom, in libraries, whatever book events, you know, to actually do the work, do the readings, have discussions with kids, because I think it actually makes a difference. Yeah. So that's the part that I really love. But that number one bestseller, that was nice too, though. I won't lie.
Right. Yeah, I mean, all the authors would like to have that. Who write books, you know,
yeah, it's great. It's a great accomplishment, you know, because once you get it, you know, that can't be taken away. Like, that happened. So, yeah, that was amazing to, you know, even get to that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said something about a classroom. Now, you teach?
I don't teach, but I've been invited to, probably been to about a dozen schools now. I've been invited, you know, as a guest author to come and do readings. I do book signings. We do some question and answer. My book is actually designed for kids who are more like, for younger kids, like 6 to 9 years old. But because of the message and the topic, I've actually been invited to speak with kids as old as 8th grade. And even though my book is the verbiage, you know, it's for a much, it's very simple words. It's not, you know, for an older reader, but it's because of the topic, educators, principals, guidance counselors, they see the value. And so what I've had to do is kind of tweak my the way that I, you know, depending on the age level or the age group that I'm working with on any particular visit, being able to engage kids as young as, I think I've worked with 3-year-olds all the way to 13, maybe 14. So, you know, I just figure out how to engage whatever age group I'm working with at any given time, and we make it work. And you have a good time.
So what inspired you to start writing children books? I mean, why did you get into that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I get asked that a lot. I get asked, is that something that, you know, you've always aspired to be? And the answer is no. I never dreamed that I would write a children's book. In my mind, you know, that's just what other people did. It's not something that I ever saw myself doing myself. But the story just kind of landed in my lap, so to speak. The story is based on a true story. It's dedicated to my oldest son, Jaden, and I'm referring to I Deserve Better. It's dedicated to my oldest son, Jaden.
Yeah, that's one thing I was going to ask you. You know, is it based on a real life?
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's his story. And the goal is to help children who are dealing with an absent or inconsistent parent and help them just try to, you know, navigate all those big and confusing emotions that come along with the territory, helping them understand that, you know, it's not their fault that, you know, that absent parent or that absent family member, whoever it is, isn't there or isn't doing what, you know, they know they're supposed to do. A lot of times when children don't have an outlet or have that person to help them navigate those feelings, they often go inward and blame themselves. And, you know, that's just not right. So that's my goal. That's the point of all of this, to help kids in those situations. Just understand that it's not their fault. It has no bearing on their value as a person, and that, you know, they can get on the other side of this, you know, and just help them do that.
Now, I just want to ask you one more thing. Now, you said it was based on the real life story. Yeah. So this actually happened where maybe one of your sons was waiting for his father?
Yes. So my oldest son, Jaden, you know, his father and I, you know, we didn't raise him together, unfortunately, but, you know, and unfortunately, it wasn't a situation where, you know, he did the right thing. And Jaden had issues emotionally because of that. So as a mom trying to help her young son figure this out, you know, together, this is how what I mean when I say the story kind of fell in my lap. And I wrote this story. So my son, I told you, is 20. He's 20. He's a freshman in college now. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote this book actually in my head like 15 years ago, Willie. Mm-hmm. And I just got the nerve, or even really, you know what? I didn't even mention it. I didn't tell anybody about it until maybe about 5 years ago. And then more recently, because I published it this past, it hasn't even been out a year yet. This past August is when I published it, and I self-published it. And yeah, it's just the timing, even though it's like, wow, you know, it took so long, it actually feels right. You know, my son was in a place mentally and emotionally where, of course, you know, I asked his permission if it was okay to put this out there, you know, because this is a little, you know, vulnerable. It's a little, to put that out there like that, it's based off him. It's no secret. And he's in a place where he was able to give me his blessing. He was so supportive. In fact, he was there that day when we met. He came to the event with me. Mm-hmm. So it was great, you know, just to have him there in person to see what I do when I do these events, you know, firsthand, but also just to show that other layer of support.
Mm-hmm. So what was the path, you know, I'm just curious, to get a book published? Ooh. I mean, what challenges did you have to go through? Because I'm sure you said you had thought about this a long time ago.
Man, I mean, Willie, they talk about trial and error.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Lots of trials and lots of errors. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I didn't even start even really pursuing it seriously to really put it out there until, you know, more recently. So it's not like I was going all that time trying to figure it out. It probably once I decided, because that was the other thing. I told you, this wasn't something that I aspired to do. Mm-hmm. So I had to go to school for this. I didn't really know anything about publishing a book, learning, you know, how to go about it, understanding that I was going to end up doing it myself and self-publishing, mm-hmm. which was fine, but just learning all the ins and outs, the formatting, the finding an illustrator, just mm-hmm. learning all the ins and outs of the different programming and the platforms like Amazon and what they need as far as publishing a book. It's a lot, but it's so worth it. It's such a amazing and validating experience, you know, mm-hmm. once you get it done. I remember the day that I got the first copy of my book and I got to touch and hold it and see it like that. It's literally, being that this story has been in my heart for so long, it's literally like the birth of a child, if you will. You know, only because it's been with me for so long and, you know, I labored, you know, putting it together and getting it out into the world. But it's an amazing experience.
So have you, prior to writing it, did you read other books about, mm-hmm. authors that were written books about kids, in particular African-American?
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was part of what finally pushed me to put my story out there, or put this story out there, mm-hmm. because I was looking for books that spoke about this topic directly, and I really just couldn't find any. You know, there were plenty of books about divorce or mm-hmm. Mixed families or different topics kind of in the same family, but not directly. You know, not directly about this topic. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, there's just, you know, and it's unfortunate that there's so many children, especially Black and brown children, who find themselves in this situation.
Right.
And it just needed, I was convinced that after not finding anything like it, you know, what do they say? If you don't see something out there in the world and it needs to be out there, you do it yourself. So that's what I did.
I like that one.
The segment is part one of Willie's interview with Taron Roberts. To find the rest of this interview with Taron Roberts, go to our website, mediasanctuary.org.
Okay, so now it's time for our weekly comedy interview, and we are delighted to welcome Bree Williams. Great to have you here in person.
Morrison.
Bria Morrison. Okay.
Bree Morrison. Yeah, sorry.
Okay. I have an old friend, Bria. Sorry. So, Bree, before this show, I got to listen to some of your shorts. You are funny.
Thank you.
And my first question really is, when did you realize that you were a funny person?
I definitely feel like I realized I was funny pretty young. I remember putting together these silly little skits to do before my like fourth and fifth grade classes, before we would start for the day. I would get up and be like, can I just do this thing? My older brother was a theater kid. He's 10 years older than me, so he was, you know, pretty old by the time I was kind of coming up. And that, I think, was a big inspiration for me, seeing that and seeing somebody be on stage and think like, oh, wow, that looks so fun. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I love making people laugh. It just feels really good.
So, Bree, you started doing comedy in 2018. How and why did you get started?
So, yeah, I started doing comedy. I took improv classes. I was living in Miami at the time, and I took improv classes and thought that was a really good time, thought it was really fun. And then I just kind of wasn't sure what I was going to do with it. And I did my very first open mic down there, and it was right before I was moving back home to where I'm from, Western Mass. And I didn't do anything for a while. I was just trying to get settled. And then I did my next open mic early March 2020. So I think we know how that worked out. and then actually very shortly after that, my mom died, and that kind of broke my brain for a little bit. And so I was, I think, just trying to cope with that. And I found that writing jokes kind of helped me feel better. And she knew that I was getting into that. And, you know, her big thing was, you know, I just want you to live your life and, you know, do what you want to do. And so I went into writing for a couple of years, and then I started doing, probably I would say 2022, I was testing the waters, but there's not there wasn't a lot. I'm not sure what it's like now, but there wasn't a lot in Western Mass to do consistently. It's not like the scene out here. And I got my first festival in 2022. I was in the Transformer Comedy Festival in Pittsfield. And then I moved back to Albany in September of 2022. And I started doing comedy pretty consistently out here, like hitting like 2-3 mics a week for about a year now.
Wow, 2 or 3 nights a week.
It's exhausting. That's terrific.
Is your comedy more of short jokes or stories? And do you get your inspiration from things that happen to you? Or are they more political? Or
It's a lot of things that happen to me, I think, is how a lot of things start. It's just kind of me thinking of something like, oh, that's so silly in my head. And I feel like it used to be a lot more of kind of stream of consciousness talking, and I'm trying to make more of an effort now to make like a structured joke, but I don't know, I feel like this is, and I've been talking to some other comedians where it's like, I feel like I say things that are funny even though they're not like a structure of a joke, and that sometimes I feel like gives a little bit of like imposter syndrome of like, am I a comedian or am I just saying funny things? But I think the whole point is to just make people laugh and have a good time, and so yeah.
Interesting. You know, I also noticed that you do a lot of comedy through the Common Folks Artists Collective.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you prefer to work as part of, you know, a collective? Or is it just that's how it's happened? Or you really like those folks?
Yeah, Common Folk, I definitely wouldn't be anywhere close to where I am and thinking of myself seriously as an artist and as a performer if it weren't for Common Folk and the people there teaching me like how to believe in myself and how to take myself seriously. I think there's a lot of benefits to being in a collective, and there's a lot of things that you can do when you have like a group of support to pull from. So I think I definitely do miss working within a collective, and I feel like we're trying to build that sense of group cohesion in Albany, in the Albany comedy scene. It's not, I would say, maybe not organized in that same like structure, but I think it's important to have a group of people because it's hard, you know, to come up with stuff and to put yourself on stage and be vulnerable and say things, and you want to know that the people who are there with you multiple times a week watching you do something are there because they believe in you and have your back. And I think there's like a naturally competitive energy, but if you can take that and put that competition into making each other better instead of trying to tear each other down, I think is really beneficial.
Yeah, you know, that sounds almost like a female or feminist perspective that you're talking about, supporting each other. Would you say that there are a lot fewer female comedians than male comedians?
Yeah, I think, well, definitely in this scene, the amount of like non-male comedians is a lot lower than like dude comedians. And I think it's for a couple of reasons. I think women are conditioned to think that our voices aren't as important and maybe the things that we don't have to say matter, or have to say don't matter, sorry. And I also think that sometimes the topics and what the comedians will write jokes about is very crude, and I understand that that's like a humor thing. It's like a edgelord, yeah. Like ha ha ha. I'm
dark gonna... humor, yeah.
Yeah, but like it's not even. I don't know. It's just mean sometimes, and or it's like I don't know. It's just I don't know. I'm a big fan of, you know, you got to punch up, you know, punch up, and I don't think a lot of sometimes that happens, and I think that can turn a lot of people off because why would you want to sit and listen to 5 people in a row say some really hateful stuff even if they're trying to do it for like the sake of the joke?
Right.
So I think that turns a lot of people off from it being like a supportive environment, and it's just like, I don't know, yeah.
That's so interesting.
So if there are females listening who want to get into comedy, how
do
would
it.
you, how would you tell them to get into comedy?
Oh my God, come out. If you are in the Albany area and you think even you're just like a little bit funny, even if you don't think you're funny, you're still probably a lot more funny than you think you are. So please come out. We need just more people because more people makes it better and you have more ideas. So we're so blessed to have such a vibrant like open mic culture. There's one every single night. You have one in McAddie's in Troy. You have
the Lark Street Tavern.
Lark Street Tavern. There's Tuesday, Wednesdays. You can actually, you know what? Ooh, sorry. For the sake of time, if you have an Instagram or social media, you can just check out at Albany Comedy, and that is the list of where everything is.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Bree, before we leave, do you want to let people know if they're interested in hearing more from this very funny woman, where they can do that?
Absolutely. If you would like to come hear me do comedy, there's a few places where I will be doing comedy. On May 4th, I will be at the Rensselaer Son of Egg for the Revenge of the Nerds showcase, which will be very fun. I've been watching movies left and right all week trying to prep. May 18th is going to be the most fun. I am hosting, and it's also my first ever produced comedy showcase. It's called I'm Not Done Talking. It's a ladies and theydies comedy night. There are no men on stage. So if you think dude comedians can kind of be come out this night because they won't be on stage. So you can come out. It'll be at Lark Tavern May 18th. We're starting at 7 o'clock, and I mean like 7 o'clock. So like come out at 7 o'clock. We got a lot of people. We have about 10 people that we're going to show for you. And I'm really, really excited. I'll also be at Rug City Bar and Lounge in Amsterdam, New York on May 25th. And just other folks, if you're looking to support women and non-binaries out in comedy, tomorrow, May 1st, in Saratoga at the Universal Preservation Hall, Erin Harkes is doing her monthly showcase of Women Aren't Funny. And then Kaylee Strafford is going to be in, it's called Quest Buds. It's like a D&D type-based thing, and that will be May 11th, I think, at Rensselaer Son of Egg. But, yeah, that's... That's all I got.
And within the last 30 seconds, do you have anything else that we missed that you'd like to say? And then where can they find you on social media or websites?
I think I've said, you know, it's everything I feel like would be good to say. You can find me at Bree Morrison Comedy. That's B-R-I-M-O-R-R-I-S-O-N Comedy. I just have an Instagram and like YouTube Shorts. I can't really handle a lot of social media. It's my ego's too big. So just bear with me. Bear with me. It's all rough, but it's there.
And thanks to Bree Morrison for coming on the show. We'd also like to thank Brad Monkel for supporting this
interview. Yeah, thanks, Brad.
So lastly, we will hear Tom Francis talk with poet Rachel Baum. She never thought of herself as a poet till getting sick in 2021, yet is a Best of the Net nominated poet. We'll also hear all that she does to bring poetry to the community, as well as warm items for families in crisis.
Rachel R. Baum is a Best of Net nominated poet, an editor of funeral and memorial service readings, poems, and tributes. She's the founder of Moving Mountains Poets and the Saratoga Peace Pod, crafters who create warm items for families in crisis, as well as the Saratoga Senior Center Poetry Open Mic host. Her poems have been published in One Art, Jewish Literary Journal, The Fair Raven's Perch, New Verse News, and others. She has two poetry chapbooks, Richard Broughton's Concussion and How to Rob a Convenience Store. In our conversation, we talk about how she began writing during the pandemic, collecting funeral poems, starting an open mic, and finding new ways to get people interested in poetry. Plus, Rachel reads the poem Rodeo Winner from her new collection.
I'm a relatively new poet. I started writing in 2021. Before that, I mean, I had a book out that was a collection of poetry that other people wrote. It was about things you could read at a funeral. And then I wrote a blog on the Times Union community blog site called Bark Confessions of a Dog Trainer, because I used to be a dog trainer. But poetry just never was in my... There was no way I was going to even think about writing until I got sick. I got sick with COVID in March 2020, the first wave, and never got better. And the frustration of trying to prove to doctors that I was actually sick, that it wasn't just all in my head. And I started writing poetry as a way to focus all that frustration, you know? Then I got into it, and that became my life.
I want to know more about the anthology that she edited, Funeral and Memorial Service Readings, Poems, and Tributes.
Well, I had... I had multiple careers, but for the longest career, I was a librarian. And people would come to the reference desk and ask, they'd say, I saw Four Weddings and a Funeral. They read that beautiful poem about the clock. And can you find it for me? That happened often enough that I thought there's got to be a collection here. So I started, I'd been accumulating poems, sad poems, since I was 9 years old. I'd tuck them into my sock drawer, and I just kept accumulating them. And eventually I came up with the idea for the funeral book. I shopped it around, and McFarland Publishers took it. They're sort of a reference publisher. It came out in 1999. It won Best Nonfiction from Today's Librarian in 2000. And it's been reprinted multiple times in hardcover, softcover. It's still in print. Yeah, so I always loved poetry. I just never thought of myself as a poet myself until 3 years ago.
Rachel hosts the Saratoga Springs Senior Center open mic, and she explains how that came to be.
I started trying to find someplace locally. I noticed that when you get older, it's difficult to drive at night, and so many of the open mics are in the evening. So I asked the senior center at Saratoga if I could start an open mic during the day. So the Saratoga Senior Center, since December, we've been doing an open mic once a month. I get a featured poet every time, and then there's an open mic for people who want to read. It's daylight and there's parking. It's well received, so I'm real happy that that launched.
I'm always curious about how we hosts and organizers can get new people involved in poetry. Rachel talks about the Poet Laureate of Saratoga and ways that she engages with young writers.
That was a really important thing for me when I initiated the proposal to have a Poet Laureate for Saratoga Springs. And we went through city council and got approved and all that stuff. And now we have, it's a position that will be there for the rest of humanity. I hope that we have a Poet Laureate for Saratoga. The first 2 years is Joe Brujac, who is a wonderful poet, and selecting him, we felt it was really important that that person, the Poet Laureate, had connections and ability to translate poetry to children, adults, people who wouldn't even think about writing poetry, reading poetry. And he's done outreach to prisons and to Native American communities. And so just in having him being our Poet Laureate to begin with, we are already reaching people that maybe didn't even think about having poetry as part of their day. I love things like pocket poems. I got a big a gumball machine, and we put poems in the little balls and we put those around. We make origami poetry books for kids. And I just think starting young, when they see it in their, not necessarily in school, because they might reject it in school, but if it's after school or it's part of just a fun game or art in the street or whatever, it's more likely to be accepted.
Finally, we talk about Rachel's new collection of poetry, How to Rob a Convenience Store. And then she reads the poem Rodeo Winner from the book.
Well, in the 70s, I'm dating myself, but in the 70s, I lived in Montana and in Texas. And this was before anything got gentrified or urbanized. Or where I lived in Montana, 15 miles outside of Bozeman, there was just a blinking traffic light. And that was about it. It was called Gallatin Gateway. Something sparked in me about a rancher that I knew, who is a little bit ominous. He came off as a swagger kind of guy, but there was something underlying, something ominous in him. For some reason, I just wrote a poem about him called Rodeo Winner. And then I thought, wow, it's got guns in it. Guns disturb the heck out of me. I'm fascinated by them, why people have them, what they intend to do with them. So I started writing more poems that had something to do with a gun, a teen suicide, a gun dealer, someone about to rob a convenience store, a mall massacre, just all the different ways that guns sort of encroach on our lives, both from the person owning the gun as well as the person who is affected by that violence. And I ended up with a book, and Cowboy Jamboree Press has published a few of my poems. They're considered good grit lit, is what they call it, grit lit. And I mentioned that I had a book about guns, and Adam Van Winkle said, show it to me. And so I sent it, and he said, this is perfect. And he let me add a couple more poems, and that's how I got this book. So I'm really proud of it. I've never seen anything like it anywhere else. And I toyed with the title because I wanted it to speak to what the intent was, but I also wanted people to pick it up because they went, what is this about? So it's sort of a small focus group kind of thing, but I polled some people and they said, yeah, we would pick up that book because it's got a catchy title. It is the title of one of the poems. I do want to mention, too, that the part of the proceeds from the sale of this book will go to the Giffords Law Center to prevent gun violence. I felt like poetry needs to make change happen. And if that's a small way that I can do it, I'm proud to be able to do it. So I'm a prose poet mostly. I like to tell a story. And this is the first poem in How to Rob a Convenience Store. It's called Rodeo Winner. And I don't mean to make a pun by saying trigger warning, but it does allude to domestic violence. Rodeo Winner. The collar and cuffs of his butternut suede jacket were so worn they seemed chewed, fringes twisted and sparse on the sleeves. He was a small man, clean shaved. He stood wide-legged, his forehead and sunglasses shadowed by the tilt of his hat. Dusty as his sharp-heeled boots, fists red-knuckled, beer bottle ready. He had a hold of her long blonde hair last night. She had flinched when he spoke, his voice booming him into height and heft. He didn't like that, the way her eyes took measure of the floorboards and not him. When they went into town, his thigh pressed against hers on the pickup's bench seat. She held his arm as they walked, his thumbs tucked under the tooled leather belt with its hubcap of a buckle he won at last year's Cody Stampede, first place in saddle bronc, so he wore it every day. She had bragged on him to her friends, but then she would say something stupid, and he had to shake the right words from his throat. He considered the .22 Colt Woodsman he used for snakes. It was locked up in the 4x4's metal toolbox, along with the Ruger Blackhawk he kept for fun. Later, maybe, he would open the box long enough to get the Ruger out, fill the yard behind the single wide with the steady whine and crack of target practice, then set it, warm from spent ammo and his hand, on the kitchen table while she made supper, like it was just another extra fork.
For Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Tom Francis.
Rachel Baum will be the featured poet at the Social Justice Center in Albany on Thursday, May 16th, 2024 at 7:30 p.m. She will be reading from her powerful book of poems, How to Rob a Convenience Store, at the Social Justice Center, 33 Central Avenue, Albany, New York. And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Kaylin McPherson.
And I'm Marcia Lazarus, and our engineer today is also Kaylin McPherson. And we thank all our volunteers who made today's episode possible. Moses Nagel, Elizabeth E.P. Press, Willie Terry, Brad Monkel, and Tom Francis. This is truly a team effort.
We want to hear from you. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at Hudson Mohawk Mag, or send an email to Hudson to HMM at mediasanctuary.org. And thank you to all our listeners for making this all worthwhile.